and it will come to an end. So, wisdom. We're going to consider today wisdom. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. So before we for the beginning, I'm going to give a few general observations and remarks about the notion of wisdom as applied in Buddhism. The first point I want to make is just a general point that we use different kinds of words in English to refer to knowing in different ways. Of course, there are many other words that we have in Pali that we're translating when we talk about these things. In fact, Pali has an extremely rich vocabulary of words when talking about knowing and wisdom and so on. But one of the things that we can look at and consider is that there's kind of a depth or a hierarchy in terms of how we know things. Right? At the most basic level is just data, right? Just raw information. Raw data, I guess. And then when you kind of structure that in a way, then that becomes information. When you learn or study that, then you can have knowledge about that. Knowledge is kind of deeper than information, but then understanding is what puts that knowledge into perspective, and finally wisdom is the deepest of all. And so I think, you know, one of the things that we have today, we have like the internet and so on, we have obviously massive amounts of data screaming around the world at unprecedented speeds, yeah? And of that data, most of it is actually kind of useless, and a certain percentage of it is presented as reasonably meaningful or useful information, right? So you think of something like, say, Wikipedia, right? So Wikipedia is a sort of structured data and gives you information about things, so that's good. But of course, information doesn't necessarily mean knowledge, right? Because you have to actually read the thing and figure out what it's saying, right? But then, more than knowledge is understanding, right? And I was talking a few days ago with some school kids, and they're saying that one of the things, if you want to learn to study well, one of the things the skill you should learn is that, you know, I see a lot of people when they're studying, they have like they write like pages and pages of notes on things, and they have like textbooks where they highlight all the important passages, and then by the end it's like the whole thing's highlighted, right? And that's nothing other than a lack of understanding, okay? So understanding is what's able to synthesize and put together all of those things and actually express it in a concise way. So if you want to show that you understood tonight's class, okay, then you should be able to summarize it in 4 bullet points at the end of the night, okay? 4. Maybe 5 if you're pushing it, yeah? Right? But usually 4, yeah? So that's a really good way to think about understanding, is you can capture that information, right, capture that knowledge. If you really understand it, you should be able to express it briefly in those few points. And if you find that you can't, then that's showing that your understanding isn't strong enough. Actually, you know, when I was at university, I never took notes. I ended up the first year of university with less than half a page of notes for the entire year. And I was recently very pleased to see that there's actually research now showing that taking notes stops you from understanding things. So all those who are sitting there taking notes, beware. Yeah? It's obvious, because when you're taking notes, you're concentrating on writing the notes rather than actually understanding what's being said. Understanding should be a kind of full-time occupation, right? So when you listen, try to understand, try to figure out what's going on. Yeah? The more you do that, the more you pay attention. Afterwards, you can recollect it, maybe afterwards. You say, much better than sitting there scribbling endless notes during a class. Much better at the end of the class, while your memory is still fresh, you think, 4 points. I'm going to write down 4 points that are meaningful and going to summarize that class. That's real understanding. But even understanding, then what's deeper than understanding is wisdom, okay? And wisdom has a quality of it brings a quality of like meaningness to something, like what's the meaning or what's the value of something, yeah? So you can kind of, I can understand a topic, right? I might understand how to do computer programming, I might understand how to do gardening, I might understand how to do education. But unless you have wisdom, you don't really see what's the point of that, Yeah. What's the point of doing all those things? How does it fit? How does it actually? Why do you spend your life doing all of those things? Yeah. And so wisdom cuts to a much deeper level of questions of like higher values and meaning. So when we're practicing Buddhism, right? So what we're doing here in these classes, we're sort of on the level of we're imparting some information, right? But I'm trying not to give too much information. I could overload you with sutta references and things, but I try to do a little bit, you know, enough, and then we get knowledge about things. Hopefully, we'll be able to develop some understanding through it. But wisdom, well, that's kind of up to you, really. I can't convey wisdom, really, in this sense. It's up to you to see what it means. And that will be very individual and will vary totally from person to person. But generally speaking, in Buddhism, with that wisdom, that deeper level, is what we really start to access through meditation when the mind becomes very clear. Okay, so this is the depth of knowing. A few preliminary remarks. Okay, wisdom. What does wisdom mean? A working definition. Wisdom is an act of understanding that generalizes from immediate experience to encompass the whole of what is possible. Okay, so remember we talked a little bit about this earlier about direct experience and inference. Okay, so we know what's happening in front of us and we look at the whole of what is possible. Okay, wisdom is not of value in itself, but because it is the key to liberation. Okay, so this is very important to bear in mind. Within Buddhism, generally speaking, wisdom is a very highly valued quality, right? It's you know, it's crucially important, but it's not an end in itself. Okay, wisdom is part of the path. The end is liberation. So the true test of wisdom is not whether your wisdom is perfect, right? Not whether you get all the answers right, whether everything is exactly right or anything like that. The real test of wisdom is, does it make you free? Yeah? And it's the wisdom that liberates you, which is the wisdom that matters. This has got nothing to do with anything, but when I was just putting together these slides, I just came across this image by accident. You see, it's called Aqua Buddha. You see that? Keep that young, healthy look by using the Aqua, joining the Aqua Buddha Club. It's kind of weird, isn't it? Anyway, moving along. That's just random. That's no wisdom to that. Okay. Okay, so in the commentaries, in the Pali commentaries, they describe three stages in the development of wisdom. And these three stages, I think, are very useful to bear in mind, even though they're one of the things that you know, even though you don't find them as such in the suttas, they're in a way summarizing a lot of ideas you find in the suttas. And they also relate to what I was talking about before with that different depth of knowing. So the first one they call Jnata Parinya, understanding the known. Second, Tirana Parinya, understanding by scrutiny. And finally, Pahana Parinya, understanding by letting go. Now, what that means, each of those has a fairly well-defined meaning. What understanding the known means is, essentially, if we come back to the depth of knowing things, so understanding the known really is that level of data and information, and maybe the level of knowledge as well. Yeah. So understanding the known means that when we're meditating, we're collecting information in a sense. Okay. So you're aware of your feelings. Ah, now I'm feeling a painful feeling. Ah, okay. Now I'm feeling a pleasant feeling. Okay. Ah, now I'm having that memory. Ah, now I'm having that thought. So you're investigating what there is. Okay. It's awareness of phenomena as they appear in the mind. Okay. This is Jnata Parinya. And this is the beginnings of the development of wisdom, and especially the development of wisdom through Vipassana meditation. And if you've ever done any Vipassana meditation, you know basically this is where you start, isn't it? You're aware of what's happening in your body, you're aware of your feelings and so on and so forth. And so you're gathering that information, okay? So this is the Nyata Parinya. Now, understanding by scrutiny, it's a somewhat obscure term, but essentially what it means is investigating those things by means of the three characteristics, anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanent suffering and not self. Or another way of putting the same thing is investigating them in terms of conditionality. Okay? So when you have, when you're doing the Nyata Parinya, you're saying, oh, now I have a painful feeling. Yeah? But when you do have the Tirana Parinya, your understanding goes deeper. You see, okay, that painful feeling, how do I respond to that painful feeling? Yeah? Where is my attachment to that painful feeling? How do I want to get rid of that? And so you're seeing much more complex the relationships between things. Right, so Tirana is much more reflective. It's not just the bare awareness of things, but it's a reflective understanding of things in their relationship. And so this is a deeper level of developing a vipassana meditation. And so that corresponds, if you like, more or less to the level of understanding in those depth of knowing things. So this is the kind of the understanding level that you're seeing how all those things work. And then finally, understanding by letting go is the Pahana Parinya. So this is where you actually become free. Yeah? And so that's where the really deep wisdom comes, yeah? Understanding by letting go. So this is actually quite useful for your meditation, and for me it's very practical, especially when you think about developing vipassana meditation. I mean, often when people talk about vipassana meditation, they say vipassana means investigating impermanence, investigating anicca, dukkha, anatta, right? And of course that's true, but that's pertaining to this second stage, Tirana Parinya. And we can only really understand the relationships between things when we know what those things are that we're talking about. Okay? So you can only know the impermanence of feeling if you know what feelings feel like. Right? You can only know the impermanence of thoughts if you know what thoughts feel like. So don't be in too much of a hurry to sort of see impermanence and those kinds of things. Your first job when you do vipassana meditation is just to know what is going on, to understand what's actually happening in your mind. Okay? Any questions on that before we go on? No? Okay. Moving on. Something I'd just like to sort of clear up as before we get too much further is the difference between ultimate truth and conventional truth. Something you hear very commonly talked about in different schools of Buddhism, including Theravada, and also in other schools as well. And this is, I think, a false dichotomy. It's a dichotomy which we don't find in the suttas at all. The Buddha never used this kind of terminology of absolute truth versus conventional truth. Now, the basic idea, which you'll see expressed in pretty much any Abhidhamma book, is that conventional reality means, in terms of like people, names, trees, and so on, the ordinary realities that we encounter in our life, whereas ultimate reality refers to the things that really, truly, really exist, like consciousness and feeling and contact and matter and things like that. Okay? The problem with this kind of distinction is it's making an invalid point, and it's misdirecting the misdirecting attention. In the suttas, actually, everything is basically conventional. Right? Everything is basically conventional truth because it's just how you know it. It's how you see it. Your perception is part of how the fabric of reality works. So the job of understanding, okay, the job of understanding is not that we somehow pierce beyond this illusory world, okay, this mere conventional world, and find the real world of ultimate reality. Okay, our job in the suttas is to understand that this conventional world is in fact our entire life. Okay, that's the point. The point is that we consciousness cannot work without conventions. It cannot work without names and labels and concepts. That's how the mind works. So as long as we are conscious, as long as we are sentient, we will be within that world of conventions with all of the limitations and problems that those things have. So the real distinction, if you think, for example, of the, say, in the physical world, right? So if you think in the physical world, we have normal ways of talking about things. We have like a plastic bottle and a table and things like that. But if you talk to a physicist, he'll say, well, actually, you know, what you're talking there is like, you know, protons and electrons and so on and so forth. Quarks and various other kind of baryons and all these kinds of exotic things. They discovered another couple of particles in CERN a couple of days ago. So, you know, there's now a longer list of things that these things are made up of. So, right? But the problem that, and so that's a bit similar to this distinction between conventional and ultimate reality, right? But the problem is that there's nothing ultimate about that way of talking about things, right? So to a physicist, actually talking about quarks and so on and so forth is no more ultimate than talking about tables and chairs and so on. It's just a way of talking about things that's actually appropriate to explain certain kinds of phenomena, certain kinds of relationships and so on. And a physicist has no way of knowing, for example, is a quark made up of more fundamental kinds of entities, right? So we have no idea whether that's the case, and until they build a particle accelerator that's bigger and can smash quarks into bits, we can't find them. I suspect, personally, that we'll never find any fundamental particles, that actually there's just relationships that keep on getting smaller and smaller down the small level and bigger up the bigger level. And I suspect that you can keep on going and never find an end to it. But maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I suspect. But anyway, the main purpose is there's no need for that distinction between ultimate and conventional reality. They're just ways of talking about things that are useful for certain purposes, that's all. Different sets of conventions that are useful for certain purposes. And the set of conventions to talk in terms of I and me and people and names and things like that are useful for purposes like having a job and saying good morning to your neighbour, you know, and things like that. Right? And for those purposes, it's fine. But the investigating in terms of feelings and things like that is useful for the purposes of meditation and letting go. Another distinction which is often lost and which is, I think, almost kind of quite misrepresented in the tradition these days, if you look in the commentaries, they do make this distinction, but they say that liberation can happen through either ultimate or conventional reality, okay? And this is something which you almost never find mentioned in the modern-day Abhidhamma teachings. They're always like, it's got to be ultimate reality. You've got to get behind the conventions and get to ultimate reality. But actually, in the commentaries, it acknowledges that this is basically a pragmatic definition. Who cares whether it's an ultimate reality or conventional reality as long as you let go? And there are plenty of stories of monks and nuns who let go while they're hearing a teaching or while they, you know, watch water disappear into the ground or all kinds of different things. Yeah, my personal favorite is one, this is a story from the commentaries, but it's a favorite of this, a monk who was going for alms round, and as he was walking for alms round, he heard a slave woman singing a song about the sufferings of life. Okay, so this is a story that's found in the discussion of the precept against singing and listening to music and going to shows, right? So he heard this slave woman singing a song about the sufferings of life, and I'm thinking, wow, they had the blues in ancient India, right? And when he heard that, he reflected on it, and then he became free, right? And he became enlightened just by hearing that song, yeah? So, you know, this is an example where it doesn't matter whether it's conventional reality or ultimate reality. That's irrelevant. The only thing that matters is, do you actually let go? So when we investigate in terms of like feelings and perceptions, when you sit in your meditation, you start to look at how your thoughts arise and so on, what you're doing is you're learning to, in a way, to break down your attachment to yourself. You're learning to break down this kind of assumption that I'm some kind of unified, coherent entity and so on. And this is useful to help you to let go. But it's not that you're sort of contacting some realm of ultimate reality. Okay? Now, another problem that this Abhidhamma theory has is that it puts very kind of oddly It puts things like the sankharas, the ultimate building blocks of the universe, according to the Abhidhamma tradition, are put on the same level, same ontological level as nibbana, right? All of which are said to be inherently existing. And this is a kind of weird problem. Now, there's another way of looking at this, which was actually developed in a fairly obscure teaching by Vasubandhu. Now, Vasubandhu was one of the great philosophers of the Yogacara tradition, lived about the 4th century. Many of his works are very famous and very well studied, but this particular teaching is not very well known of Vasubandhu, but I think is one of his most interesting ways of presenting things. And so he found a way of talking about these distinctions without using the words ultimate reality and conventional reality. Okay, so how did he talk about it? Well, first he talked about the parikalpita, which we can think of as the imaginary or the conceived or the thought about. Right? And so the parikalpita is basically similar to the conventional world of names and persons and things and so on. Then the second level is the paratantrika, which is the interdependent. Okay, so the paratantrika is very essentially similar to the level of vipassana meditation. So that's when you're seeing feelings and perceptions and contacts and thoughts and so on, and you're seeing that they're interdependent, they rely on each other and so on and so forth. So it's like seeing at a more precise level. And then we have parinishpana, which is the perfected, which refers to nibbana. Right? So we have a threefold division rather than the twofold division. And so it's not making any claims that any of these levels are ultimate or are the realer, this one's really realer than the other one or anything like that. It's just saying that there are these different ways of perceiving reality and so on. So when there's a genuine distinction to be made there, but it's not an ontological distinction. It's a distinction in terms of what are the strategies and the means that we're using for realizing awakening. Okay? Any questions? Yes. I suspect it's impermanent. Yes, go on. Is Nibbana impermanent? You've just disproved Buddhism. Oh my God.
You want me to say that again? I say you flash everything and say everything is impermanent. Yeah. So Nibbana, is that also impermanent?
Is Nibbana impermanent? No. Well, the saying is sambe sankhara anicca, all conditions are impermanent. Yes, so Nibbana is unconditioned, so it's not impermanent. So it's a kind of interest. The Buddha does a very interesting and a very nuanced dance around that little point, right? Now he says Nibbana is dhuva, which means stable, and he uses words like pitta and so on, which means like steady and so on. But he never quite says Nibbana is permanent, right? So it's certainly not impermanent, but the Buddha never quite says that it's actually permanent. Yeah. So. Yeah. What about not self? Is Nibbana not self? I mean, Nibbana is obviously not dukkha, right? It's not impermanent. It's obviously not dukkha. Yeah. So we have anicca, dukkha, anatta. What about not self? Is Nibbana not self? Nibbana is not non-self. So it's self. Sorry? It's not both. Ah, you're very adept at getting around these questions. Very good, yes. Okay. So it's just another random image. That's a Prajnaparamita, perfection of wisdom image, from Borobudur, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, so we come to the suttas. Just as when we talked about meditation, we gave a number of different terms that we use for talking about meditation. So the same thing with learning wisdom. Again, I don't want to try to systematize it too much. Like, you know, I'm well aware that if we look in the commentarial tradition, just by the way, people who are taking photos, all these PDFs are available for you, so you can just get the PDF and use it and whatever. But anyway, feel free to take photos if you like. I'm wary of making things too systematic, right? I think if you always kind of end up squeezing square pegs into round holes if you try to make things too systematic. But nevertheless, we'll just have a general look at some different aspects of wisdom that we find in the suttas. Okay, so one that we have is bahusutta, is much learning. Okay, and this is, of course, what we're developing by being here. So yay us, right? And so this is something which is very highly praised by the Buddha. One of the qualities that's mentioned repeatedly of great monks is that they are very learned. So we should always take the opportunity to listen to the suttas, read them, study and learn from the suttas. Just to sort of explain the term here, you notice the last element of the term is sutta, S-U-T-A. This is not the same word as the word sutta with two T's, okay? This is actually a past participle meaning to have heard something, okay? So remembering in the India that it was all oral learning, right? So to learn something means to have heard it, yeah? So this means of much, literally having heard much, or more idiomatically having learnt much. Alright, so, but of course Buddhism is not just about learning. And learning things is only the beginning. So what we're doing here is a foundation, but we certainly shouldn't be rest content with that. We need to see how much further we can go with it. Second aspect of wisdom that's mentioned very many times in the suttas is patisankha. There are different words that are used to express this, but the basic idea is that of reflecting on what you have learnt, right? Or reflecting on what you're doing. Yeah? So you're thinking about it in a reflective way. What does it mean? How do I apply it? And so on and so forth. So learning is not a passive thing. Okay? And any educationalist will tell you this, that it's a matter of applying your mind, figuring things out, reflecting on them, working through problems. And so this is like an active stage in learning. Okay? Another stage that we develop in wisdom is through discussion, right? Not just with yourself, but discussion with others. And this is something the Buddha mentions repeatedly as being essential for developing wisdom. And I think it's amazing how progressive the Buddha's education program was compared to what we've done in many of our schools up until very recently, or even up until now. And you see that in much education, including a lot of Buddhist education, unfortunately, it's all basically just rote learning, right? So they get this bahusutta bit, so you learn everything. But there's no real encouragement or training on how to reflect on things, yeah? Then still less is there an encouragement on how to discuss them. And in many, even, you know, my experiences in many different monasteries and so on, there's really no opportunity to discuss the Dhamma. And even asking questions and so on can be perceived as being rude and threatening, because basically I think monks are afraid that you'll see that they don't really know what they're talking about. So discussion is good. Yeah? Reflecting is good. Asking questions is good. Yeah, and so let learning be an active experience. Yeah. In fact, you know, there's the more of that, the better, really. Anyway, applying to experience. Yoniso manasikara. Now, yoniso manasikara is used in a lot of different contexts, sometimes in quite a subtle and profound context, but sometimes also in a more everyday context. And what it essentially means, the word yoniso means by way of cause, okay? So it means reflecting by way of cause, or looking back to the causes and sources of things, asking about reasons, okay? Okay, so reflecting on the reasons of things. So, for example, you might hear, a teaching that might say that if you're nursing a grudge against somebody, then that will create suffering for you. Something like that. Just a simple example. And then you sort of go away and you actually apply that. And you go to work the next day and then you realize, oh, when you meet that person that oh, you didn't really want to meet them. And then you realize you'd actually been nursing this grudge against this person. And you've been thinking all these bad thoughts about them for such a long time. And then you look and, oh, there is that suffering. And you see that that's actually happening within yourself. And so that teaching has been like lifted off the page. It's been reflected, you've accepted it, and now you're actually applying it in your life. Okay? So this is that yoniso manasikara. Okay? Next one we have vipassana, which they usually translate as insight. I prefer discernment or clear discernment for it. There's a very nice passage in the Mahapadana Sutta that gives a very good idea of what's meant by the word vipassana, and it's discussing one of the past bodhisattvas of Vipassi Buddha, right? So his name is Vipassi, literally meaning someone who has vipassana, right? And so it gives an explanation why is he called Vipassi, and it gives a couple of explanations for why he's called Vipassi. One reason was that he could see and discern things that were very far away. Okay, so he had very good eyesight. He could see things that were off in the distance. So this is why they called him Vipassi, right? Because he had clear seeing. Yeah? Clear seeing. He could discern what was far away. So this is one aspect. And the other aspect that it talked about was that when he was a child, he was still only a young boy, his father was the king, and his father, while he was hearing court cases, would get his little boy and put him on his lap, and his boy would listen to the court cases, and his son would draw the correct conclusion about the outcome of the court case. Okay? So he was able to make accurate decisions and judgments about court cases even when he was a young boy. So that's a notion of inference, isn't it, right? So you hear the stories and so on, you figure out who's telling the truth, who's not telling the truth, what actually happened, and you can infer what the appropriate, what actually went on and what the appropriate thing to do about it is, yeah? So these are the two aspects of vipassana which are mentioned there. One is the clear seeing, and the other one is the ability to draw inferences. Alright? Another aspect of wisdom that it talks about in the suttas very often, yatha bhuta jnana dasana. Okay? Yatha bhuta jnana dasana. Usually translated as knowledge and vision. What does it say? Knowledge and vision of things as they are. But it doesn't really say things as they are. That's a slightly problematic translation. But anyway, the word bhuta here, so this is kind of break up the compound. Jnana means knowledge, dasana means vision. Yatha means as or like or in the way of. Okay, bhuta means... Bhuta has a couple of different meanings, but one meaning is truth. Okay, so if you're a bhuta wadi, you're a speaker of truth, all right? But bhuta also means what has become. In other words, what has been conditioned, what has been brought to be, all right? So we can understand it in both of those senses. It means like knowing reality, knowing the truth, but also it's more specifically, it means knowing things in accordance with conditionality, right? Knowing things as they've been produced through dependent origination. Now, this phrase usually is used in the suttas only of a stream enterer, okay? So, it might not always be used in that context, but most of the time it's the stream enterer who's said to have yatha bhuta jnana dasana, to know and see in accordance with reality. And those who are not stream enterers usually are said to have these more preliminary forms of wisdom. And you find that distinction made in a number of places in the suttas, especially in the... one place which I can't remember, but it's a really good one to know. Is it the Kilesa Samyutta? Somewhere in the Samyutta. Anyway, if you're interested, ask a question later and we can have a look at the sutta. So generally a stream enterer or someone who's higher than a stream enterer is said to know and see in accordance with reality, whereas those who are not have rather lesser forms of knowing. Then we have the asava kaya jnana, which of course knowing the end of affliction, the end of defilements, of course this is the knowledge of the arahant. Okay. Then there also is a kind of knowledge called pachavekana, which means reviewing. And pachavekana can happen at different levels, so it can be just an ordinary kind of reviewing. So, for example, when we finish our meditation, you can reflect back over the meditation and look at how that went, and this is a kind of pachavekana. But pachavekana is also employed in very profound sense of, like, when the arahant has become enlightened or someone realizes these deep states, then they reflect back on them, they review that process, they review what's actually happened. So there's like a process of assimilation of that truth and that revelation which has occurred. And that process of assimilation might go on for some time. Particularly in the case of a stream enterer, if someone realizes stream entry, they don't necessarily realize exactly what has happened at that time. Okay, they'll know that something's happened, and they'll know that something very profound has happened, a very profound shift has happened, but it takes a while through reviewing and reflection to look and see exactly what defilements have been let go of, what defilements are still remaining, and what is the path that needs to be practiced. So that just doesn't happen automatically. It happens through that process of reflection or reviewing. Okay, so there are many other words for wisdom in the suttas. The suttas, in fact, are extremely rich in that vocabulary, as you might expect. But these are a few of the more important ones. But any questions about these terms before we go on, or any other terms which I'm missing which you'd like to have a few words on? Yes, we have a microphone, is on its way.
I just want to clarify that this particular slide actually shows the stages in sequence, or is it actually just random?
It's kind of a bit like stages, sort of, yeah, but not like really fixed. Yeah. You don't find this particular set of things as a set in the suttas, but generally it sort of starts out with the more preliminary ones and goes up to the higher ones. Yeah. Well, what do you mean by whole? Well, it goes up to arahantship, so that's pretty good.
So this whole thing is already it's a full set of wisdom. There's nothing higher than...
There's nothing higher than ending the defilements, no.
No, there's nothing higher than this pachavekana,
reviewing. Yeah. Whatever, yeah, that's right. Yeah, we've done the full Monty. All right. But like I said, there are many different ways of talking about wisdom in the suttas, so this is just a few of them.
Ajahn, regarding the last reviewing, just wondering what go through in the various stages of the sainthood, what go through in the process of when they review, because like just how you mentioned, even though you attain the stream entering, you're actually not sure what has happened.
Mm.
And what are they checking or what they are reviewing in order to affirm to themselves saying that, hey, indeed I sort of like get it.
Well, the first thing is that the experience of stream entry, or any of the noble fruits, is a very definite and very clear experience. Okay, so the Buddha described it as like a flash of lightning in the darkness of the night. So it's a completely unmistakable experience. And this is something which is actually emphasized in the Vinaya, because if there's a case of a monk who says he has a certain attainment and the other monks want to see whether he's telling the truth or not, the first thing that you do is you ask him, well, when did this happen? Right? Where were you? What were you doing at the time? Right? And somebody should be able to very clearly say, you know, it was at such and such a time, such and such a place. You know, if someone's vague about that and can't really say, then that's a sign that it's not a real experience. So that's the first thing, right? So the experience itself is very clear, but the interpretation of that experience is not necessarily so clear. All right? So you know something happened. You know what that experience was, but you don't necessarily know what that experience is called, and you don't necessarily know all of the implications of that experience. Right? So for example. There's an interesting sutta when the Buddha's discussing with Sariputta, and the Buddha says that I've never actually let on this before, but a stream enterer can't go to hell, right? And this actually is something which these days is quite common knowledge in the Buddhist community, right? If you become a stream enterer, you're freed from rebirth in any of the lower realms, so that's good. But even Sariputta didn't know that, right? He was actually enlightened, but he didn't know. And the Buddha said, actually, I didn't say this before because I thought that all the stream enterers would be lazy, right? So that if they knew that they weren't going to go to hell, then they just, oh, just take it easy, relax, yeah? So he wanted them to try a bit harder in their meditation. So, you know, that shows, it's very interesting, that shows that even those experiences, that even Sariputta was a great arahant, even he didn't necessarily know all of the implications about that experience, yeah? So with someone who becomes a stream enterer, remember that enlightenment and these attainments are essentially cessations, okay? That's what they are. They're cessations. They're the ending of the permanent, complete ending of certain forces in your mind which lead to suffering, okay? Certain forces which you, for time immemorial, have clung on to and identified and been attached to and thought were intrinsic to who you were. And suddenly, those things are not there anymore. Yeah? So the essential experience of these things is an experience of absence. Right? Those things, you didn't even, but before those things, before you had that experience, you didn't even really know what those things were. Right? I mean, you had the bahosata, you had learning about them, you'd reflected about them, you'd discussed them, you'd applied them to their own experience and so on, but you'd never really penetrated and see them in accordance with reality. And so that experience of stream entry is exactly that experience of seeing these things for the first time, yeah? And letting them go and seeing what is the absence of these things. And so because it's a completely unprecedented experience, right? It only happens once. Then you don't have, you know, how do you make sense of it? How do you know what's going on? And often what happens at that time is that it's an extremely powerful and transformative experience. It's like the world turns upside down, or like your whole kind of mind explodes into a million pieces and then comes back together. Yeah? I mean, you can't use a simile or a metaphor or a description of that practice which is too extreme. I mean, it's the most revolutionary thing that's ever happened to you in your entire existence in samsara. Yeah? So all of these things go on, and well, am I an arahant? Am I fully enlightened? Am I, you know, a once returner, a non-returner, whatever? Maybe it happens to you, and you don't actually know all that much about Buddhism, right? You might have learned some simple Buddhist teachings and things, but you're not familiar with those teachings on the different stages of enlightenment and so on. So you know this thing has happened. You know you've seen this impermanence, and you've let go, but you don't really know what that means, huh? And so that takes a while for those things to settle down and just to reflect. And gradually what will tend to happen is that the experience is so powerful that it like blows all your defilements out of your mind, okay? So it's just like this flash of light and this flash of wisdom. So all the defilements are just shot out of the mind, right? But not all of those defilements are completely ended, right? So only some of them are ended completely, and the others are just waiting for their time, right? And so you maybe think, oh, you're fully enlightened or something, but then later on maybe some of the defilements might creep back in, right? You find yourself, you know, getting some lust coming back or getting some desire or something like that. Or someone does something and you get annoyed and you realize, oh, actually, you know, there's still work to be done. There's still more to be done here. Yeah. Yeah. Microphone.
In line with what you just said, some school of thoughts, some school of thought has said that wisdom can not really be expressed or described, but can only be experienced. So is it in line with what you have just said?
Well, if that's true, then I'm just wasting my time and we can all go home.
You just said that you don't know what happened, you know, it's just something just flashed. So that's something that It's not truly justice to the meaning of wisdom.
I'm not impressed by that kind of thing. I mean, have you ever played a musical instrument? Yeah. So when you look at a musical piece of music, like sheet music or something, can you capture everything about that music on the sheet of paper? Right? Of course you can't, right? You can capture part of it. Can you ever describe what a piece of music is like? Of course not. Can you describe what a chocolate cake tastes like? Right? Of course not, yeah? So our descriptions, the way we talk about everything, even simple and mundane things, is very limited, and we can never capture it. And wisdom is no different. Right? Of course we can't capture everything about the experience of wisdom, because language is limited. Right? But we can capture useful things about it. Right? So if you're doing a recipe book, you don't necessarily have to describe every detail about making a chocolate cake and what it tastes like and everything, but you just have to have enough detail that they can actually bake the cake. Right? So that, again, this is a pragmatic nature of wisdom. So can we capture everything there is about wisdom? No. Can we capture enough about wisdom so that we can actually help us in our practice in a useful way? Yes, we can do that. You certainly may. Please, we have two questioners over here. Let us hear their words of wisdom.
You know, this process of wisdom is that it could be one aspect of, maybe I heard about Four Noble Truths, you know, and then and I reflect on it. Is it through my meditation or through my daily happenings, you know, that kind of thing? And then maybe I come for sutta class, and then I discuss, and these are the process. This learning is only one aspect, the maybe Four Noble Truths. And then maybe later I know about dependent or origination or interconnectedness. And this is the wisdom that is the a whole lot of wisdom is that,
yes.
that slowly that we come to know the reality. It's not just one aspect.
That's right. Yeah, all of those different things are contributing.
So,
yeah.
All this process is an ongoing thing. It's in your mind. You can be doing things and you realize. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
And then it's through but what integrates them all is samadhi. Okay, so when your mind becomes peaceful, then all of those things you've learnt, all the discussions, all the reflections, all of those different aspects of wisdom that we see here, they all come together, and
yeah.
that's what allows them to really fruit in that deep letting go.
So wisdom and meditation must go
hand in
together,
hand,
and then that's where we will go forward.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. I know.
Good. Excellent.
Bhante, Nibbana has been described as the stilling of all sankharas.
Yes.
But the way to it is to develop wisdom. But you know, when you still, you let go. Is that a rational event or an emotional one?
Ah, both. Yeah, I don't know about if rational is the right way, but yeah, both. There's both. But it's partly an emotional and partly like a function of wisdom or intelligence, yeah. Yeah. You have the lovely sutta where it talks about, it's in the Anguttara 2s, I believe, it talks about the Vijja Bahagya Dhamma, the dhammas that pertain to release and realization. And it says that samatha and vipassana, so tranquility and insight, are Vijja Bahagya Dhammas, dhammas that pertain to realization, and it says that through samatha, leads to the abandoning of
passion.
Yeah, raga viraga, yeah, and development of vipassana leads to the abandoning of ignorance, avijja viraga, and so they work together, and so always needs to be integrative, and the real realizations happen when those things are all there and they're all working together.
Is it why the Buddha said that the jhanas and the formless attainments are, metaphorically speaking, nibbanas?
Maybe.
Because there's a very strong emotional content to the jhanas. Yeah. And you get there by letting go of things.
Absolutely, yeah. And they are, you know, they're also described as that, like anupubha nirodha, the gradual cessations. So yes, it's, you know, in jhanas, you know, you've let go of most things. You know, the five external senses have been let go of, the hindrances have been let go of, thinking's been let go of, past and the future have been let go of, right? I mean, you've there's not much left. So it's just that little bit more that it's a kind of next step. Yeah.
Thanks, Bhante.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, please. At the front, new questioner, please.
Just one short question.
The short questions are the most dangerous.
Experience, applying to experience could be the ups and downs in realizing the truth or something like that. You know. Applying to experience
yeah. Right,
could
yes.
be the ups and downs that you have gone through. Okay.
Yeah, it can be. Yeah.
Okay, I'm finished.
Where does your dukkha come from? Where does your happiness come from? Please.
Ajahn, just wondering, when a person becomes a stream enterer, how would he or she know that? I mean, would he or she know it? And then the second question is, out of curiosity, whether have you ever met anyone that actually has achieved the stream enterer stage, and you know, like, what's their experience that they shared? Thank you.
Okay, so first question, and I think I talked about that before. Like, a stream enterer would certainly know that something has happened. They'll know that something profound and liberating and wonderful has happened. They'll know that it's completely unlike anything that they've ever experienced. Yeah. They won't necessarily know what that experience is called, right? It doesn't come with a label on it, right? If they've learnt Buddhist teachings before, they would probably suspect that that's what it is, and they would then do that kind of reflection and reviewing and so on, maybe discuss it with other people and so on to sort out exactly what that is. But it might take a little bit of time before that process is complete. So that's that reviewing process. But the defilements are gone. That's the important thing, right? The important thing is that those defilements that lead to rebirth don't exist anymore. Okay? So the Pachawakana process is not about that. It's not about getting rid of the defilements or anything like that. It's just about, in a sense, just assimilating that and integrating that with the rest of your mind. Yeah? So they will know that. Have I met anyone who's a stream enterer? Well, there's a few people who have like websites and stuff where they advertise that they're stream enterers and arahants. So yeah, you can go and view those, and may it be so. What can I say? I've met a lot of really good practitioners, and so, but you know, I've long ago stopped. Stopped thinking that I have some kind of right to go judging other people's spiritual attainments. Yeah. I remember when I was a young monk in Thailand, you know, this is kind of thing, it's like really common. Everyone's like, oh, so-and-so is an arahant, so-and-so is a stream enterer, you know, all of these kinds of things. And you know, I heard, you know, sometimes monks are like controversial, right? So Ajahn Buddhadasa, for example, was this kind of great teacher in the south of Thailand, and he was very controversial. And some respected monks who were supposed to be arahants with psychic powers said that he was an arahant, right? And others who were also respected monks with psychic powers said that he was burning in hell. So, you're kind of thinking there's not a lot of middle way there. So I take these kind of stories with a bit of a pinch of salt if I hear people say these things. But, you know, what the Buddha said in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is that as long as there are people practicing the Eightfold Path, then the world won't be short of arahants. So I think a much more interesting question, much more useful one, is rather than asking, are there stream mentors and arahants and so on around, but are there people who are practicing the Eightfold Path? And that's something that you can get a better sense of, right? It's not so speculative. You can actually look at how people live, look at their understanding, look at their behavior, and see whether that's in line with the Eightfold Path. Yeah? But of course, even more important is seeing whether your practice is in line with the Eightfold Path. Yeah? So if you want to know whether there are really stream enterers in the world, there's one surefire way to do that, and that's to become a stream enterer. Okay? Everything else is just imitation. Okay, so we have been talking for a little while, and we should do some meditation. All right. Yeah. So the question, because it wasn't the microphone, I'll just repeat it. The question was, is there any emotional involvement in the different stages of wisdom? Very much so. And we'd like to know things, right? This is something that you see is like the basis for something like Wikipedia, for example, right? Why do people write on Wikipedia, right? Because it feels good to know something, right? And to share your knowledge with people, yeah? So knowing is actually pleasant. Yeah? Not knowing is suffering. In fact, you could say that knowing, that understanding is actually the deepest pleasure that you can have. Yeah? And you know how distressing it is if you're in some environment where you just don't know what's going on, right? It can be so confusing and it's extremely stressful. But if you're the one who knows, it feels really good, yeah? If you're somebody at work and then somebody new comes on to work, they don't know anything, they're confused, they're stressed, it's their first day at work, it feels good to help them. It feels good to share your knowledge, and they become happy when they get some of your knowledge. So actually knowing is always pleasant. When we're developing meditation, you're developing wisdom through that, there's always this kind of sense of satisfaction when you come to that, that realization. Yeah. Okay, so how does wisdom work? Again, just a few more reflections on this. First of all, wisdom is not a special faculty, right? It's not that wisdom is it's not a kind of new thing, right? But it's a developed form of ordinary understanding, okay? Always remember this in Buddhism, all of these qualities that we're developing, they're just ordinary qualities of mind. They're qualities that you already have. All right, so you already have wisdom and peace and love and all of these things, but we're just developing it, that's all. All understanding is an unpredictable knowing that arises mysteriously. In other words, all understanding is intuition. So have a think about this. We've talked about this a little bit earlier in the course, right? But what about the idea that knowing arises mysteriously? Right? We don't know, and then there it is. Where does it come from? So what goes on is that the information is processed, the data is received, the information is processed, and so on. And this happens largely unconsciously, and then it arrives more or less whole. So you think about that when you're trying to work out the answer to a problem or something like that. You think about it, this and that, and so on and so forth. And then suddenly the answer is just there. Right? The solution comes to you as a whole. It's very mysterious, actually. So this process where there's a pattern or a rhythm, okay, between two aspects. One is the active aspect of investigation, inquiry, and so on. And then the other is the passive aspect, forgetting about it. It's non-rational. It's an emotional state. Both of these are essential. And those quiet things, those non-rational states, typically that might be dreaming, might be daydreaming, it might be just relaxing in the bath, right? So you know the classic, the eureka moment, right? Yeah, the story of Archimedes. Yeah, do anyone know? Everyone know that story? Eureka moment and Archimedes. You know, do you remember what he was what the problem was he was trying to solve? Displacement of. Do you know why do you know why he was trying to solve the problem? Yes. Sorry? He wanted to float in the bath? Go on. He had a more pragmatic aim in mind. Go on. Ah, yes. That's right. The goldsmith made a statue for the king. It was supposed to be pure gold, but the king suspected it had been adulterated with lesser metals. So how do you figure out whether a statue is pure gold or not, right? I mean, if you have cubes or ingots, then you can work it out because you can measure the size of it, compare it to pure gold, and then figure out whether it's the same. But how do you do it with a statue? Yeah? Not at all obvious. Archimedes, of course, classically was reclining in his bath. If he tried to figure out this problem, hadn't been able to solve it, and then he just forget about it, you know, I'll just lie down, have a bath, and he lies down in the bath and sees the water level going up. And then he realizes that's how you do it, yeah? You measure the amount of water that's displaced, and that will tell you the volume of that statue, and from the volume of the statue, you can compare it with the weight of the statue, and from that, you can work out whether it's pure gold or whether it's been adulterated. So then, of course, he leapt up from the bath and ran naked down the streets, crying, "Eureka, Eureka, I found it," yeah? So, but of course, the interesting thing about that experience, I mean, that's an archetypal story. Whether it actually happened, we don't know. But what's interesting is that if you look at the details of the lives of all of the great scholars, all of the great artists, all of the great philosophers, they all come to their great realizations the same way. Yeah? And the physicists talk about the three places, the bed, the bus, and the bath. Okay? They're the three places where physics actually happens. Notice the blackboard is not one of them. All right, the computer terminal is not one of them. All right, these are not the places where the deep insights happen. The deep insights happen when you forget about working out the problem, when you forget about getting all the details, and you let your mind relax, let your mind be at peace, and it will solve the problem by itself. Yeah? So the powerful thing about this, from a Buddhist point of view, is to understand that it's samadhi which performs that role. Right? And samadhi performs that role of relaxing in the bath or having a daydream or anything like that, but it performs it at a much, much, much more profound level. Okay, the kind of consciousness, the peace and the clarity that you have through samadhi allows that wisdom to be assimilated and those insights to happen at a far more profound level. And that works for ordinary insights. It works if you're a creative person, you have to figure out, you know, how to do some graphic design or something like that. It works if you're a writer. It works if you're trying to figure out what the right thing is to say to somebody who you've had an argument. It works if you've got some problem to solve. It works all of those different cases, but it also works to get free from suffering. Yeah? It's the same thing, the same principles working in the mind. Yeah? So here's a summary. How does wisdom work? Wisdom is informed by knowledge, integrated in stillness, accompanied by confidence, and leads to peace. And so this idea accompanied by confidence is that emotional side of things that we were talking about before. When you have an insight, you know, there's a knowing there. You know, that's the answer. Right? There's an emotional charge to it. Yeah? So wisdom is informed by knowledge, integrated in stillness, accompanied by confidence, and leads to peace. So there's obviously some deep peace going on there. I'm not sure if it's peace informed by wisdom. Somebody pointed out, a few weeks ago I read something, somebody pointed out that the only reason why your cat doesn't eat you is size. It's true though, isn't it? Yeah. All right, So we've been reflecting about kind of the nature of wisdom, the general principles underlying wisdom. Let's have a look now at the content of wisdom according to Buddhism. And so, you know, mentioned that these principles will apply in any kind of context, but of course in Buddhism we have our own kinds of things that we want to understand. Most obviously the Four Noble Truths, suffering, origin of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the path, the way of practice that leads to the ending of suffering. So, all of the Buddha's teachings can be summarized or included in these Four Noble Truths. So, I could talk about that for hours, but I just want to move along a little bit and look at some other aspects. So they have the fields of wisdom, the three characteristics. Often this is how Vipassana meditation is summarized, and quite nicely, impermanent suffering and not self. And emptiness is sometimes included there. Generally speaking, when we talk about emptiness or sunyata, in the early suttas, it usually is kind of more or less a synonym of not self. Okay, so they pretty much mean the same thing. But there's an interesting distinction between the Pali suttas and the Agamas, especially the Sarvasivadin suttas, and usually the Sarvasivadin suttas will mention emptiness, so they have the four characteristics rather than the three characteristics. And of course that was where the Mahayana teachings were largely derived from, those suttas. So for example, if you look at Nagarjuna, the great Mahayana philosopher, and he emphasizes emptiness a lot. And actually it's very quite interesting, because in some of his teachings, Nagarjuna quotes or mentions phrases which are very quite powerful and quite influential, but which you don't find in the Pali canon. For example, one phrase he mentions is that dependent origination is emptiness. Okay, now, that's not something that you find stated in the Pali canon, and so if you come from a Pali background, you read that and you think that Nagarjuna is sort of making an innovation, that he's saying something new here, right? He's approaching things from a new direction. But actually, he's not doing that at all. He's actually just quoting from the Sanskrit suttas, the Sanskrit Sanyuktagama, where it actually does have a sutta you don't find in Pali that says that dependent origination is emptiness. Yeah, and so Nagarjuna was not, in that respect anyway, not making an innovation. He was merely reminding his audience of something which was well known and which he would have understood, that they all knew already. So, but generally speaking, emptiness in early Buddhism means the same thing as not self. So these things are different aspects, different characteristics of experience which we scrutinize and understand through wisdom. And help us to be able to let go. Okay, so seeing the impermanence of things, right? Seeing that things have the nature to come to an end, then you don't hold on to them so tight. Right? When you see things are dukkha, see things are suffering, then you're more willing to let go of them. And the same thing with not self. All of the things we identify with, we hold on to. We think this is me, this is mine, this is what I am. We let go of those things. Now, the classical description of these things, it says sabbe sankhara anicca, right? All conditions are impermanent. Sabbe sankhara dukkha, all conditions are suffering. Sabbe dhamma anatta, all dhammas are not self. So why is it different? Why does it shift from saying sankharas, all sankharas are impermanent and suffering, but all dhammas are not self? Because Nibbana is asankhata, is unconditioned, is that right? Yeah? Okay? Right, and that's the kind of, curiously enough, right? That's become a standard explanation of that, which you find in the 20th century, but you don't find it earlier than that, right? And the classical explanation of this phrase is actually different. But the problem with that explanation, and this was pointed out many years ago by the monk Venerable Kheminda, was that sabbe dhamma anatta is repeatedly and very consistently shown to be like part of a vipassana practice which is leading to dispassion, right? So when you see dhamma, sabbe dhamma anatta, then you'll see that all dhammas are to be got rid of, to be let go of, to be expelled, and so on and so forth. So clearly the dhammas there are meant to be dukkha, they're meant to be suffering, and that's what you investigate in order to let go of them. So to explain that as nibbana doesn't seem to work. So what does it mean then? Why is sabbe dhamma? What's the difference between dhamma and sankhara? Sankhara means conditions. Dhamma means... well, dhamma, doesn't it? Right? So any other ideas? What's the difference? Come on. Okay. Okay. Yeah, I think there's something to that. In the suttas, when it talks about this particular phrase, okay, it says sabbe sankhara anicchati and so on and so forth, right? Then it says this is that dhamma titata, dhamma niyamata, that regularity of dhamma, that natural law of dhamma, right? So this is the point which comes back to the point of permanence and nibbana of permanence, right? So for example, is the principle, right, that all things are impermanent, is that principle impermanent? Okay? Things have been impermanent in the past, they will be impermanent in the future, they are now permanent now, so therefore all things are impermanence is permanent. So therefore, it contradicts itself, doesn't it? If impermanence is permanent, then everything blows up, and then Buddhism just drops down in a chaotic heap, and we're all wasting our time. The only constant is change. Yeah, exactly. It's another way of expressing the same thing. All right. So the point here is that impermanence isn't a sankhara. Okay, impermanence itself is not a conditioned phenomena, right? So impermanence is, if you like, a principle or something like that, which is actually just a description of things. So when we say that things are impermanent, we're not saying that impermanence is something that actually exists in the world, right? We're merely saying that when we observe phenomena, we can observe that thing, that process of change. So it's just like a description. In Pali, we call that a panyati, right? The word panyati means a description or a concept about something. So impermanence is just a description, right? And the laws of nature are just descriptions of things, right? So when we say something's impermanent in that sense, you're not saying that there's an existing thing which was there in the past and future. All that you're saying is that things tend to behave in similar kinds of ways, and you can describe them in similar kinds of ways. Okay? So it's not saying that there's anything exists, but that description and the way of talking about things is dhamma. Okay, and that natural principle, that regular natural principle, is the dhamma pittata, the dhamma niyamata, the regularity of dhammas, the natural principle of dhammas. Yeah? And so that is what it means when it says sabbe dhamma anatta, right? So that the principles of dependent origination, the principles of the Four Noble Truths and so on, we can't really say that those principles are impermanent, we can't say that those principles are suffering, but we can say that those principles are not self. Yeah? So this is what the Dhamma means in this sabbe dhamma anatta. Yeah? The Dhamma is literally the Dhamma itself. The principles of Dhamma is also not self. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Saying that the Dhamma is not self, was it meant specifically to address clinging to Dhamma?
I suspect so, yeah.
Because in the Mula Para MN1,
yeah.
There's also this problem about clinging to Nibbana.
Right, yeah. Although that's, I think, a bit controversial. I think it doesn't have that passage in the Chinese version, if I remember correctly. But yeah, I think I think that's exactly right, that's what that's getting at, yeah. Yeah. So, sabbe dhamma anatta, all dhammas are impermanent. That means that impermanence is kind of permanent, but kind of not really. That's the technical way of putting it. All right, next one. fields of wisdom, five aggregates, right? So here we're getting a bit more specific. Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana. Form. I hate the word form. Oh, it's terrible. Feeling. It's so vague, and form is just so vague and meaningless, and I really dislike it anyway. Form, feeling, perception, activities, or Sankara, and consciousness. So these are the five aggregates. Now, the way that these five aggregates are presented in the suttas, again, is somewhat different from the way that you usually hear about it in modern Buddhist explanations of the five khandhas. They'll typically say the five khandhas are like five categories in which you can classify all of the different things that's going on in your body and mind, but that's not really how the suttas talk about it. What the five khandhas mean, firstly, is firstly to understand that the five khandhas are not regarded in the suttas as being a distinctively Buddhist teaching. Okay? On the contrary, they're frequently used in dialogue with non-Buddhist ascetics and so on, and they seem to have been a fairly widely recognized group of teachings. Right? So, but what they are, what they seem to be originally, is five kinds of things that we are most apt to identify as self. Okay, so if you look at all the theories of a self and a soul which people had in ancient India in those times, they would usually identify one or other of these khandhas, or some combination of them, as being their self. So most obviously we identify our body as our self. Yeah? This is me. Yeah? And perhaps then you might think, well, maybe this is not me, but maybe when I go to heaven, I'll have like a subtle body or a body of light or something, and then that will be me. Right? But then sometimes that gets a bit crude, right? You begin to reflect on it and you think, am I really my body? My body's changing and so on. So when I die, for example, you might think, I'm going to go to a realm of bliss and I'm going to experience bliss and pleasant feeling. Yeah? So this feeling is me. Yeah. So, I am my feelings. Yeah. But then you realize actually my feelings are kind of changing and so on, right? Sometimes I feel happy and sometimes I feel sad. And so if the pleasant feeling is me, where do I go when I feel sad? Right? And so this is this process that you can see through philosophy and reflection, that these people's ideas about their self gradually get more and more subtle. Then the idea of perception, a sankhara, perception is yourself. So perception is a bit more subtle. It means like a kind of recognition or interpretation, the way that you see the things and the way that you identify with things. And so there's also these different kinds of devas, different kinds of gods. Maybe a god is like percipient of light. So there's this perception of light, which that's yourself. Right? So, for example, like people have like near-death experiences. Yeah, they die, and there's this like light, and they merge, and that light is my soul, and so on. So it's like perception, or activities. Right, sankhara is like acts of will, choices that we make. So your choices, you identify with those. I remember something that George W. Bush said. He said, I am the decider. Right? I am the decider. Yeah? So he's identifying with this sankhara, these acts of volition. And of course, the five khandhas is actually a very interesting and very subtle group of dhammas, because they have their own evolution within them. If you look at that in terms, for example, of childhood development, okay, then you actually see that process of evolving identity is actually how children evolve their sense of self as they grow into adults. Yeah. So initially a child's sense of self is based purely physically, right? It's about their body, right? And they are their body and they identify with that. Then it's about pleasant feeling, getting things to eat, getting what they want to have, and so on and so forth. So children are very driven by their desires to avoid pain, right? They're so affected by pain, right? And pleasure and so on. Then you get this idea of sanya and perception, and sanya and perception is very associated with the awareness of a sense of self. Right, so it's identifying with things, right? So when kids grow up, especially when they come to maybe adolescence or something like that, then they start strongly identifying with things. They might be, I'm a fan of such and such a band, or I play such and such a kind of sport, or you know, I wear this kind of clothes. You know, they get together in like gangs. They identify themselves by the particular clothes that they wear and so on. So they're developing their sense of identity and their sense of perception. Yeah, and as you grow up again into maturity and into adulthood, then adulthood is characterized by decision making, right? So your ability to actually make the choices for how you're going to live your life, yeah? And this is a sankhara. Yeah? So that process of the khandhas actually reflects a real process of evolution and childhood development. So all of those kinds of things, they're like layers of the self that we find within us. In the Brahmanical scriptures, they sometimes use a metaphor of a sheaths, like that there's like wrappings. So there's like layers of wrapped of the self. And as we practice, we can gradually undo those layers, and we come back more and more and more to the core idea of a self, which is vijnana and consciousness. Now, the idea that our consciousness is our self is very, very subtle. In fact, it's so subtle that it's really only the province of people who are maybe meditators or contemplatives or philosophers and so on, right? Most people don't get beyond the idea of thinking of their sankharas, their choices and decisions and acts and achievements as their self. The idea that consciousness is yourself. And this is something, in fact, which is almost absent. And I think this is the defining difference between Western and Eastern thought, the most important difference. In Western thought, you almost never encounter this idea of consciousness. People seem to be uninterested in it, and the idea that awareness itself is who you are is not something which you find addressed in the Western philosophers at all. Whereas it's absolutely fundamental to all of the Eastern philosophies, especially Buddhism, obviously, but also Hinduism. And you first find this idea emerging in the Upanishads. It's pre-Buddhist texts, about 100 or 200 years before the Buddha. And you have these great philosophers and these Upanishadic sages, especially one called Yajnavalkya. Yajnavalkya lived in India, in the region of Mithila, roughly 100 or 200 years before the Buddha. And there's a number of very profound and very interesting dialogues that he has recorded, especially in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. And in one of those, he goes through, and he is quite astonishing because he goes through all of the things which are self and which are not self. And many of Yajnavalkya's teachings are actually very similar to the Buddhist idea of not self. Right? And his most famous phrase is neti, neti, yeah, neti, neti, not that, not that. Yeah, or perhaps this might be his second most famous phrase. His most famous phrase is probably tad tuang asi, yeah, thou art that. Yeah. But the second most famous said, not that, not that. And so he goes through everything. He says, it's not for the sake of your clan, right? It's not for the sake of your land. It's not for the sake of your family. It's not for the sake of the ones that you love. It's not for the none of these things are what really ultimately matters, but it's only yourself that really matters. So he uses this technique of not self. Everything is not self, right? Everything is not self, not self, not self, not self. Except for this one thing. Yeah? All that's left is this one thing. And what is that self? Vijnana ghanameva. Yeah? A sheer mass of consciousness. Yeah? That is yourself. That tad tuang asi. That is the Brahman. That is the divinity, which is the cosmos. Yeah? And so this is that stage which those sages had realized before the time of the Buddha. And it's a very profound, very subtle, and very beautiful teaching, right? Of all the philosophies that are in the world, right? That's the probably the best one, right? Yeah? It's such a great insight. Because why? Because they realized that when you know that a feeling is there or a feeling is not there, right? Knowing is always there. When you know that your thought is there or your thought is not there, the knowing is always there. Yeah? And so Yajnavalkya has this phrase, he talks about the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the unknown knower. Yeah? He is yourself. Yeah? Yeah? So as the one who sits in the middle and sees all of those things going around. And of course, how do you see, how do you know the knower of all of these things? Right? How do you know the knower of all of those things? I can see that all of these things are impermanent. That's fine, right? But every time I see that, there's a knowing. So isn't that knowing permanent? Right? And so this is that stage which those philosophers had reached, and that was the great insight which the Buddha broke through, to see even that consciousness itself was impermanent, that consciousness itself was conditioned, that it itself changes. And that's the profundity of his insight. That's the core profundity of the Buddha's insight, to see that consciousness is vijnana. Actually, to see that vijnana or consciousness is impermanent. All of those other ones, that people already realized that before the time of the Buddha. But vijnanam anicchang, that's, I think, the core insight that the Buddha made. Yeah, of course, yeah. You're not alone. Yeah. Sorry? If you try to explain non-self, your mind will blow up.
That's what I think it's.
Okay. Okay, so how do we know this? How do we see that the awareness is impermanent? Well, okay, so partly what we have to do is we have to try to catch it out of the corner of our eye, okay? Because how do you know the knower of everything, right? So you see that vijnana or that consciousness as it's reflected in everything else, okay? So now, in fact, vijnana is changing all the time, right? Let's take an obvious example is when you go to sleep, right? Now, when you're asleep, there's a certain level of consciousness there, right? If you hear a loud sound, you wake up, right? Maybe you dream. If someone pinches you or something, you wake up or you feel it. And sometimes, you know, you can feel like feelings or smells or sounds. You might not consciously hear them, but they might make their way into your dreams, right? And so that actually shows that even though you feel like you're unconscious, actually there is a consciousness there. And then, of course, you wake up. And that goes through a period of change. When you first wake up, you're drowsy and groggy and so on, and gradually your mind lifts and you become more clear. So consciousness is changing, right? So even though consciousness is always present, it's present in different forms. Yeah. So this is one of the aspects to look at. And the other aspect is to look at that consciousness. Consciousness never works in isolation. Okay, so in the Upanishads, it has this idea that you have consciousness, which is the ground of knowing of all things, and you have all the things have their specific names and their specific shapes. Okay, which we call nama rupa. Right, so nama rupa in the Upanishads means the specific forms that things take in the world. Right, so you see a tree, you have a shape that tree have, and you have a name for it. And everything in the world is like that. There are things, and things have concepts. So you make sense of the world through your concepts. And these are all diverse and various, right? And they're all impermanent. And it gives the metaphor. But just like all the rivers have their individual names and shapes, but they return to the great ocean, right? And when they return to the great ocean, they lose their name and their shape, and you just refer to it as the ocean. So in the same way, when nama rupa dissolves, all the various diverse things of the world dissolve, all that's left is that vijnana, okay? But the Buddha came along and said, no, that's not correct, because vijnana is dependent on nama rupa, okay? Consciousness depends on all of those other specific things, yeah? Think about it in terms of that metaphor, right? Actually, the metaphor of the oceans and the rivers, right? It's a very persuasive metaphor. It's a very powerful metaphor, actually, right? But until you talk to a meteorologist, right, who will tell you that the ocean doesn't just somehow exist there independently of the rivers, right? But the rivers are actually filling the oceans, yeah? And the ocean's evaporating and falling into the rivers. And there's actually a process and a cycle of which the oceans are a part, right? The oceans aren't just there permanently all the time. They're part of a changing process. Yeah? So it's the same thing with consciousness. It seems like it's just there as a ground of being. It seems like it's always there, right? But actually, if you look closely, you understand the system, you see that it's always interdependent. It's interdependent with your thoughts. It's interdependent with your feelings. It's interdependent with your memories and so on. And so it's changing and altering all of the time. And so these are some of the insights that come through the deeper level of vipassana meditation. And this is also one of the reasons why it's very important to develop samadhi, because with samadhi, that the clarity of the knowing mind becomes much more aware. And so you start to see vijnana, you start to see consciousness much more clearly.
Another example?
Another example, besides the ocean.
A bit more clearer. I'm saying a bit of it, but it's not enough.
All right. But another important aspect of wisdom is similes, right? The Buddha said through a simile that some people here can understand what was said. Let me think for a minute. Good simile. So somebody else might have, please speak up if you can think of one. If I was the Buddha, I'd have the perfect simile, but I'm not, so sometimes I have a good one, sometimes not.
A sheaf of reeds. Two sheaves of reeds.
Go on.
But I'm not the Buddha.
Really? Oh, okay. Okay, well, yeah, so this is a simile that the Buddha used to illustrate how these two things, nama-rupa and vijnana, are always conditioned by each other. He said they're like two sheaves of reeds, like you tie up the rice at the end of the season and you lean them up at bundles against each other. And if you pull one off, then the other one will fall down as well. So this is like illustrating that idea of the interdependence of consciousness. And consciousness is the awareness, and nama-rupa is the things of which we are aware. Yeah. So the basic principle here is that consciousness is never pure. Right? Consciousness never happens by itself. It's always consciousness of something. And so it's always conditioned. So when we meditate, we always look at that consciousness as being conditioned. So these basic practices of vipassana that we see mentioned hundreds and hundreds of times in the sutta. Cakun cappatita rupe ca upadati caku vijnanam tiemam sangati paso. Dependent on the eye and forms arises eye consciousness. The coming together of the three is contact. Yeah? This is a basic description of experience. Right? Visual consciousness only happens when there are these things which are there to condition it. Yeah? If you don't have an eye, you can't see. If there's no light outside, also you can't see. Yeah? If there's no consciousness, also you can't see. So the coming together of those three things, tiemang sangati paso, when those things are all together, then you have like that sense stimulus or sense awareness. Yeah? So consciousness is something that only arises in those conditions. Okay? Does that help? So this is the five aggregates. So that just brings us on briefly to the six senses, another one of these fields of wisdom. So these different topics that we've looked at, the Four Noble Truths, the Nicca Dukkha Anatta, the five aggregates, the six senses, and so on and so forth, these are all different ways of approaching that the topic of wisdom. We don't necessarily need to employ all of these things, right? And there's a lovely sutta in the Sanyutta where somebody goes to a monk and says, you know, how do you get enlightened? He says, well, investigate the four elements. And he goes to see another monk. He says, how do you get enlightened? He says, well, you investigate the five khandhas. And he sees another monk and he says, look at the six senses. And he sees another monk and he says, look at dependent origination. He goes to the Buddha and says, I'm just so confused. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing, right? And so and that's where the Buddha gives the simile of the blind man and the elephant, right? So you're actually they're all telling the right thing, but they're all pointing to one part of it, one part of the truth. So actually the Buddha used a simile. He said that each one of those monks is explaining the truth as they have understood it and they've penetrated it and they've practiced it. So each of these things is like giving us a different angle, and they can each be taken up and used for practice in our meditation. So the elements being another one, and of course dependent origination. I'm just skipping through these things now, and we are probably at the time where we should have a break. So let's have a break for 15 minutes, and we'll come together at 9 o'clock for the final discussion session. Okay.
Ajahn.
Let's get going. Let's see, what is wisdom and how have I experienced it? How have I understood it? Okay. Let's go. So that's going to be us very shortly. So we've come to the end. All things are impermanent, including courses on early Buddhism. So I don't have too much I want to say to wrap up. I might just say that my own kind of impressions that, you know, I've given this course three times now, and it was a little bit of an experiment doing it in this way because it's quite a different format than we've used before. If I was to do it again, I'd probably put a bit less, try to cover a bit less ground. I think that we maybe were a bit ambitious with covering a few too many topics. So maybe next time, some people shaking their heads, some nodding. But anyway, we might think about that for next time and try to spend a bit more time with some things. But apart from that, I've been very happy with the course, and I've been very happy with your presence and your attendance and good humour and good spirits and patience. And like I said, I've taught this course three times in Sydney, in Perth, and now in Singapore, and each time we've had a fantastic response. And I think that it's a sign that there's it's kind of hit a spark, that we've got an idea that there's something which is a kind of a need in the Buddhist community. And for many years I've noticed that there are, kinds of knowledge and understanding which we find in the academic sphere in Buddhism, which is not really communicated into the popular sphere of Buddhism or actual Buddhist practitioners. And there are, not to say that everybody needs to be a Buddhist scholar, but there are some things that we can learn. And so even though, I understand that for most of you, you're not going to end up being the world's greatest sutta scholar or anything like that, nor should you be, because then I'd be out of a job. So I want you to study the suttas, but not too much, okay? Because then I want to still be the expert. No, only kidding. I want you to be the experts, yeah? And so then the next time that I come to Singapore, I can just sort of, sit back and watch you guys, and you guys can explain the Dhamma. That would be wonderful. But, to come back to the thing, like when we're thinking about the suttas, remember that in the development of wisdom, that much learning and so on, this is a part of our path, okay? So don't think of the suttas. It's not like a curriculum that you have to master. Don't look at all of those books and think, oh, so how do I read such big books and all of these kinds of things and all that's difficult and so on. But if the suttas are your friends, the suttas are the voice of the Buddha. Yeah, and so we have this incredible privilege that we can actually have the voice of the Buddha by our sides. We can stick it in our pockets and carry it with us. We can take the voice of the Buddha on the bus with us. We can have it by the side of our bed. And it's like we can have a good friend who's there to advise us and admonish us and encourage us and challenge us whenever we want. Yeah? So this is how we just think of the suttas, and to just maybe see for yourselves, if there's some kind of regular practice or regular reflection that you can do, even like, maybe reading one sutta a week, or, just spending 10 minutes a week reading suttas. They're very powerful. And give them the time to digest. Don't try to do too much. Just do a little bit regularly, little bit by little bit by little bit. And gradually you'll learn to appreciate it. Yeah? Even though it might take some time, little bit by little bit, you realize that you come to just appreciate so much to have that voice of wisdom and sanity and reason and compassion and kindness, which is just there for you whenever you need it. Yeah? So, I encourage you all to make this a part of your practice, just as meditation is part of your practice and keeping precepts is part of your practice and being a kind and good person and practicing right speech and all of this is part of your practice. And so reading the suttas also should be a part of your practice as well. So I thank you all so much for your attendance and for your attention during this time. And I think that you're all very good people. And I think that you are all very kind and have a lot of wisdom. And that of those people in the world who have little dust in their eyes, yeah, I think we have quite a few of them here in this room. Okay, and so I want you to take the whatever wisdom that you've learned here, see whether you can grow it and develop it, and also see if you can share it with others. Yeah, and so that wisdom of the Buddha, I honestly believe is just the most wonderful and most precious thing that there is in this world. So if in our lives we can find it in ourselves to understand that wisdom a little bit better, then that, I think that's a life worth living. And if we can share that wisdom with others, then that's even better. So a special thanks also to Beta and the other wonderful people, Ong Chin and other wonderful people here at BF, who have put the course on and have invited me here and have supported and encouraged it. And so I've been coming to BF now for, I think, about 10 years, a bit over 10 years, I think, now, since I first came. And so, you know, for me, BF is kind of like a home away from home. So I know that if I ever get stranded at Singapore Airport and got nowhere to go, I can always find somewhere. And I, you know, I must say I'm always very impressed when I come here and I see the community and I see there's such a warmth and a sincerity and dedication in Dhamma practice. And it's a very rare and a very beautiful thing. So congratulations for building this community, and I hope that you can continue to do so in the future.